Daily News via remote. I'm Laurel Bowman. Russian Foreign Minister Sergey Lavrov visited Congo Republic on Monday, the second leg of an African tour aimed at strengthening Moscow's ties with a continent that has refused to join Western condemnation and sanctions over Russia's invasion of Ukraine. African countries, which have a tangled legacy of ties with both the West and the former Soviet Union, have largely avoided taking sides over the war in Ukraine. Many import Russian grain and increasingly energy too, but they also buy Ukrainian grain and benefit from Western aid flows and trade ties. Lavrov has already visited Egypt and will head from Congo to Uganda, then Ethiopia. Africa is also being courted by the West this week, with French President Emmanuel Macron due to visit Cameroon, Benin, and Guinea-Bissau, and U.S. Special Envoy for the Horn of Africa Mike Hammer on his way to Egypt and Ethiopia. The first ships to export grain from the country's Black Sea ports may move within a few days under a deal agreed on Friday by Ukraine, Russia, Turkey, and the United Nations, a UN spokesperson said Monday. A joint coordination center will liaise with the shipping industry and will publish detailed procedures for ships in the near future, said Deputy UN spokesperson Farhan Haq. Moscow brushed aside concerns that the deal could be derailed by a Russian missile strike on Ukraine's port of Odessa on Saturday, saying it targeted only military infrastructure. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky has denounced the attack as barbarism that shows Moscow cannot be trusted. Russian Foreign Minister Sergey Lavrov said on Monday there are no barriers to the export of grain from Ukrainian ports. For more news, visit voanews.com. This is VOA News. Myanmar's ruling military has executed four democracy activists accused of helping to carry out terror acts, it said on Monday, sparking widespread condemnation of the Southeast Asian nation's first executions in decades. Sentenced to death in closed-door trials in January and April, the men had been accused of helping a resistance movement to fight the army that seized power in a coup last year and unleashed a bloody crackdown on its opponents. Former Finance Minister Rishi Sunak said on Monday China represented the largest threat to Britain and world security this century, setting out his plans to deal with Beijing in the latest front in the battle to become prime minister. Sunak and Foreign Secretary Liz Truss are fighting in an increasingly divisive Conservative Party leadership contest to replace Boris Johnson after a revolt against his scandal-ridden administration forced him to say he would stand down. Draupadi Murmu was sworn in as India's president on Monday, making her the first person from one of the country's marginalized tribal communities to serve as head of state. The former schoolteacher and state governor was elected to the largely ceremonial position last week with 64% of the vote by members of India's parliament and state assemblies. Murmu is from the Santhal tribe and was born in eastern Odisha state. Analysts predict she will help Prime Minister Narendra Modi extend his base among the poor tribal communities ahead of his re-election bid in 2024. India's Prime Minister wields executive power, but the President can send back some parliamentary bills for reconsideration and also plays a guiding role in the process of forming governments. Murmu is the country's second woman president after Pratibha Patil, who held the position for 5 years from 2007. A weather emergency was declared in Karachi Monday as heavier-than-usual monsoon rains continued to lash Pakistan's biggest city, flooding homes and making streets impassable. The heavy downpour also disrupted flights and train operations in the megacity of 15 million. The monsoon, which usually lasts from June to September, is essential for irrigating crops and replenishing lakes and dams across the Indian subcontinent, but it also brings a wave of destruction each year. The National Disaster Management Authority said at least 312 people had died since June as a result of the monsoon rains. For more on this and all the stories we're covering, visit us at voanews.com. We also have an app that you can download. Just search for VOA News. Reporting via remote, Laurel Bowman, VOA News.
is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yeheyes Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
It's interesting that it's a physical visit rather than just online visits. I think it's deliberately calculated to show that Russia is not isolated, that Russia still has friends in the world, that Russia still cares about Africa.
That was Stephen Groost, head of the Russia-Africa program at the South African Institute of International Affairs, on Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov's four-nation trip to Africa. Details coming up. Also, French President Emmanuel Macron begins his first ever visit to Cameroon today. These stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. Tunisians are voting today on a new constitution promoted by President Kais Saied, who has been accused of working to give his office nearly unchecked powers that critics say could lead to an autocracy in the birthplace of the Arab Spring. Saied, a 64-year-old professor, won the 2019 presidential election in a landslide, building on his image as incorruptible and distant from the political elite. While Saied enjoys some popularity, that is being tested by soaring inflation, youth unemployment of 40%, and a tough loan deal with the International Monetary Fund. Journalist Lisa Bryant is in Tunis covering the referendum. She spoke a short time ago with VOA's Kate Pound-Dawson about how the voting is going.
Well, so far it seems to be going very well. That at least is what I have been seeing personally. I spoke to an election observer at one of the polling stations. He said so far also, nothing irregular that he's seen, at least in terms of the vote itself. It was very regular stream of people coming in and coming out, and, nobody looks particularly enthusiastic, but it looks like that there may, at least at the initial hours of the vote, be higher than expected turnout.
Now, you mentioned that the turnout is higher than expected. Why was it expected to be lower?
Yeah, it was expected to be lower. And, we'll see what the final figures will be, because on the one hand, people are disillusioned by what's happened since over the last decade since their revolution. There's not a lot of enthusiasm going in the way there was, for example, the very first time they voted after the 2011 revolution. Then also in large part because the opposition has called on its supporters to boycott this referendum. They say it's illegitimate. It's basically denigrating everything that the Tunisians have voted for or fought for over the past decade in terms of free expression, in terms of basic rights. So, all of that and election experts were predicting, maybe a 10% turnout, which maybe towards the end we'll find out is the case. But, the EC, which is the Electoral Commission, was saying it was higher than expected in the early morning hours.
What is the mood there among voters and among those who perhaps are not voting? I think you've spoken with both.
That's correct. And I went to two polling stations today. The mood among voters is, look, we've had more than a decade of turmoil, economic free fall, prices are soaring, cost of living is just becoming unaffordable. We're getting poor. We don't see this revolution that we fought for delivering anything in terms of sort of bread and butter basics. So, what could be worse? We're going to vote for this document, this constitution, because things couldn't possibly be worse. Some are voting because they're sick of corruption. Some are voting because they support the president, Kais Saied, who's pushed through this draft constitution. So it's a mix of things, but generally the idea is we haven't seen Anything good delivered, it's great to have, you know, the Arab Spring democracy, but in terms of delivering for us on our daily lives have not gotten better. So that's the sentiment of the people who are voting, and all the people that we spoke to were going to vote yes, whether they're super enthusiastic or it's a vote against what they have now. On the other hand, in terms of the opposition, that's a lot of the opposition parties, this parliament that was essentially dissolved, civil society, the opposition also includes journalists. But among the opposition who have called for the boycott, there's a sense that this very fragile democracy is basically going to die with this constitution. So there's fear. There's also disgust. Some people said it's an insult, you know, to everything we fought for, because they claim that this draft constitution, which really, really expands presidential powers and dilutes legislative ones and judicial ones, is essentially a return to decades of autocratic rule that Tunisia experienced before 2011.
That was reporter Lisa Bryan in Tunis speaking with VOA's Kate Pound-Dawson. Russia's Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov is visiting Egypt, Ethiopia, Uganda, and the Republic of Congo this week, trying to counteract Western blame of Russia for a growing global food crisis. Experts say Russia will push its own narrative as to why it's attacking Ukraine and use the visit to show it has friends. Mohamed Yusuf reports.
Russia's foreign minister was in the Republic of Congo Monday to meet with the leadership of the Central African nation. Minister Sergei Lavrov is on his second day of his African tour to bolster international support for his country. Steven Grast is the head of the Russia-Africa program at the South African Institute of International Affairs. He says Russia will play the victim card when meeting with African leaders.
Is a propaganda war as much as it is a shooting war. And we've seen from the Ukrainian side how successfully President Zelensky has used social media. He gives daily messages. He's talked to parliaments and to Congress and groups around the world virtually. He's seen it being on the front line. And Russia's mounting a counteroffensive. So I think this is all part of that same trend. It's interesting that it's a physical visit rather than just online visits. I think it's deliberately calculated to show that Russia's not isolated, that Russia still has friends in the world, that Russia still cares about Africa.
In Egypt, Lavrov met with the Arab League leadership, seeking the support of the group's 22 member states and accusing the West of ignoring his country's security concerns. He's expected to do the same when he visits African Union headquarters in Addis Ababa. Wale Olusola teaches international politics at Nigeria's Obafemi Awolowo University. He says Russia is using the African visit to clean up its image after invading Ukraine and seeks to influence the continent.
The visit actually reverberates across all of Africa. So there is a message it sends, you know, globally in terms of the new relationship that Russia is trying to court. Russia can make a big deal out of these visits to at least give the impression to other members of the global community that it is not isolated. The other part of it may be a long-term gain, you know, for Russia. These kind of visits are not just diplomatic or purely on the surface. Certainly, we expect that some deals may be signed or maybe just informally agreed upon, you know, with Russia, especially with respect to countries that are having issues with security.
The Stockholm International Peace Research Institute says Africa imports almost half of its military equipment from Russia and knows that arms export is a critical component of Russia's economic growth. The number of African countries buying weapons from Russia has grown to 21 from 16 in the 2000s. A handful of countries are also using Russian-supplied mercenaries. Olusola says African countries should use opportunities such as Lavrov's visit to push for their own interests.
A country like Russia, certainly, even though it cannot play the same role as China and United States has been doing in Africa, certainly do understand that such relations with Africa will come at a cost. You know, I must be willing to provide, you know, some kind of concrete economic support, financial support, you know, for these challenged economies, you know, in Africa. I think it's an opportunity for these African countries to restate, you know, African position on the Ukraine crisis. And of course, to see ways out beyond the Western relations and the benefits they get from Western countries, they can also open new vista of relations with Russia in a way that serves their own national economic interest.
At the United Nations General Assembly in March, 38 African countries condemned Russia's war on Ukraine. But supporters of Ukraine accuse African countries of doing too little to hold Russia accountable for its invasion. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
Regional authorities, medical professionals and residents of Ethiopia's Afar region say they are in dire need of medical aid, with hundreds of hospitals and health centers destroyed by conflict. The World Health Organization says it is struggling to fulfill the country's needs as crises around the world intensify. Henry Wilkins reports from Barhel, Ethiopia.
Mariam Abdallah Ali lost her daughter in May after the toddler swallowed an object found on the floor. But when we went to the local health centre, they told us that they could not perform an operation on her because they didn't have the right equipment, she told VOA. The doctors said they had to go to the city of Samara for the operation, but her daughter died on the way. All lives in the town of Bahale in Ethiopia's Afar region, where Tigrayan forces who occupied the region until April of this year destroyed healthcare facilities before they left. The regional government says 60 health centres in Afar were put out of commission by the occupying forces, though Tigrayan forces and the Tigray regional leadership deny the allegations. Dr. Mohamed Hussein Abdullah, who works at the centre where Ali took her daughter, said they no longer had the equipment to save her life. He says the health centre was one of those where medical devices were available. In the past, they used to perform operations because all the equipment and the medications they needed were at the centre, but the TPLF destroyed it completely. The Tigray People's Liberation Front, TPLF, did not respond to VOA's request for comment on the damage in the region. In the nearby Kanaba district, a health centre was ransacked and severely damaged. Kadir Deresa Humed is the health centre's medical director. He says the medical laboratories have been completely destroyed and they cannot carry out health checks because they do not have the medical equipment, even treatment for AIDS and diabetes. He adds there's a big shortage of medication and the lack of electricity has a negative impact. While the need for food aid in Ethiopia has been dominating the headlines, officials say there is a great need for medical services too. The UN's World Health Organization says that just 22% of healthcare facilities are fully functioning in Afar and the neighbouring Amhara region, compared to the period before Ethiopia's conflict began in late 2020. The WHO says medical and food aid must be combined to be effective in Ethiopia.
Whether it's in terms of essential supplies, whether in terms of monitoring for infectious diseases, whether it is in terms of immunization services or services for mothers and children, it's really important for these services to be provided at the same time as food.
For Ali, aid came too late to save her daughter, but for others, there may still be time. Henry Wilkins for VOA News, Bahale, Ethiopia.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Please note we have moved our programs from voanews.com to voaafrica.com. There, you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. Find us on voaafrica.com. French President Emmanuel Macron begins his first ever visit to Cameroon today as part of a three-country West Africa tour that will include Benin and Guinea-Bissau. Analysts say Macron will discuss security and economic concerns amid an upsurge in conflict and terrorism, as well as rising prices and fuel and food shortages caused in part by Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé, Cameroon.
Bulldozers raise makeshift market stalls and buildings Monday morning in Tongolo, a neighborhood in Cameroon's capital Yaoundé. Among the several hundred stall owners is Julio Evina. Evina says it is regrettable that officials are destroying businesses along some major streets in the capital Yaoundé and rendering families hungry simply because French President Emmanuel Macron will be visiting Cameroon. He says if not for Macron's visit, he is certain that the government would not have filled potholes that have been causing accidents on the roads in Yaoundé. France says Macron will discuss the food crisis in Africa, provoked in part by Russia's war in Ukraine, as well as the challenges in increasing agriculture production in Africa and an upsurge in insecurity. Cameroon faces Boko Haram terrorism that has killed over 30,000 people and displaced 2 million within 10 years in its northern border with Chad and Nigeria. The Central African state also faces separatist conflicts that have killed at least 3,300 people and displaced more than 750,000 in 5 years, according to the UN. Capo Daniel is the deputy defense chief of the Ambazonia Defense Forces, or the ADF, one of the separatist groups. He says the ADF hopes Macron will ask Biya to end the use of force as a solution to the separatist crisis in Cameroon's English-speaking regions.
One of our factions in our liberation movement called for lockdown as a means to protest Emmanuel Macron's visit, but other movements will be watching these events with the hope that Emmanuel Macron will be pushing Paul Biya to choose the path of peaceful resolution of the war.
Politicians and civil society groups say they will discuss with Macron the possibility of a peaceful transition in Cameroon. 89-year-old President Paul Biya has been in power for close to 40 years, and critics accuse him of rigging elections to prolong his power until he dies. The government says he has always won democratic elections. France says after Cameroon, Macron will visit Benin and Guinea-Bissau. Ejani Leonard Kulu is a political scientist and an analyst at the UN-sponsored University for Peace Africa program in Addis Ababa. He says Macron is expected to review his country's economic, political, and security ties with Africa. Kulu says African countries that have agreements with France are now seeking profitable partnerships with other world economies.
We saw the president of the African Union and the African Commission going to Russia to see how Syrians will not be blocked for Africa to have food. If we take the case of Cameroon signing a defense treaty with Russia, Cameroon surrendering mines, expectations to China, question France positioning and even giving a sentiment of anti-French. So France wants to reposition themselves against other partners like China, like Russia.
The government of France says Macron is accompanied by the French ministers of foreign affairs, armed forces and foreign relations, as well as the French Secretary of State for Development. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
Speaking at a recent ceremony to pass one of the most significant federal gun safety legislations in decades, U.S. President Joe Biden decried the increased gun violence in the country, saying that it had turned everyday places in America into killing fields. Studies show that gun violence disproportionately affects African-American communities, many living in poor neighborhoods in places like West Philadelphia, which has experienced an increase in cases of fatal shootings. VOA's Jackson Mfungane visited a shooting victim in Philadelphia and brings us this report.
As the wave of horrific mass shootings dominate daily news in America, the issue of gun rights and the Second Amendment continues to be part of a heated national debate. Statistics show that across the U.S., there has been an uptick in the number of victims of gun violence. The rates are especially high in urban areas, with large cities like Philadelphia setting an all-time record for homicides last year. And figures show that even though we are halfway through the year, 2022 is on pace to be the most violent in the city's recorded history. West Philadelphia, or West Philly, is what some urban experts would refer to as an inner city. It is also home to a thriving Liberian-American community. David Bonney, who we first met in 2015 in Liberia's capital, Monrovia, on my trip to cover the Ebola pandemic, moved to Philadelphia 5 years ago to continue his college education. He works part-time as an assistant manager at a local Rite Aid. And even though gun violence in his neighborhood has been featured on the local news, he was too busy with work and school to pay close attention to it. That changed in June of this year when David, walking home in the early hours of a summer morning, was confronted by a gunman a few meters from his home.
I was shot 6 times, and I got, like, multiple wounds in my leg. Some of the bullets penetrated my leg, and one of the bullets got stuck within my muscles. One of the bullets also fractured my femoral bone and also my femoral bone right here. And then one of the bullets also cut one of my veins in the back of my leg.
David says that he was lucky that none of the bullets hit him above the waist.
That's the fascinating part. I really don't understand. How did those bullets get, you know, all the way down there and not up here? But thank God it didn't hit me up on my upper range. But, you know, I'm very grateful. I'm really, really grateful that I'm alive.
Like many African immigrants, David did not think too much on the issue of gun violence. He says that he felt that that was more of an American debate.
We Africans, we really try our best to stay, you know, just stay very quiet.
Out of trouble.
And out of trouble. Because, you know, that's how we're raised. We stay out of trouble. We just work very hard. You know, take care of ourselves and our families.
Reports say that in the U.S. this year, each day on average, over 300 people are killed by gunshots in multiple forms of violence, including assaults and murders. David says that one of the lessons from this traumatic experience has been to dispel the stereotype that all young black male victims of gun violence in inner cities are always gang members or somehow connected to illegal drugs.
My hope and prayer to the world, to America, and the rest of America, I would love for you guys to understand that every young black man is not the same. You cannot put everybody in the same category, because some of us are strong young black men who work very hard. We're intelligent people. We work very hard to build our communities, to make our communities a better place. And if something like this happened to me, or other young men out there, all the victims out there, the police should take the time to investigate. The police should be able to at least be in consultation with the families of the victims.
As David hails from his auntie's house, 20 minutes away from his old neighborhood, he hopes that police will continue following up on his case and possibly catch the shooter. But with the increasing cases of shootings in the area, that is likely to be another statistic of an unsolved shooting. For Voice of America, I'm Jackson Mfungane.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyes Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, and our engineer, Joe Gill, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.